Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm your host today, Linda P. Jones from Be Wealthy and Smart. Happy New Year to everyone and to our crew today. Joe Salcihi from Stacking Benjamins. How are you?
What's happening, Linda?
Oh, great to have you back. I missed you.
I missed you too. It's sunny here in beautiful Texarkana, Texas.
Oh, good. Miranda Marquette from Planting Money Seeds and Adulting. How are you?
I am doing well. It's great. We've got snow, but instead of being below 10 degrees like it's been for 3 weeks, we are seeing a heat wave. It is 25 degrees, and I am ready to go.
25! Oh,
wow. A heat wave.
That's what it feels like at this point. I didn't even have to build a fire this morning.
Wow, good. And Doug Goldstein, all the way from Israel, from Goldstein on Geld and Rich as a King. How are you, Doug?
Doing okay. It is actually 25 degrees here too, but that would be 25 degrees Celsius. So it is sunny and gorgeous as it is about 98% of the time.
Lovely. Sounds nice. Not bad here in the desert either, although we've had a bit of a colder spell. I actually have the heat on today, so that tells you something. Well, great. Well, I hope everyone had a happy new year. We are going to do some listener questions today. Are you all ready?
Oh, man.
Ready to roll?
Rock and roll.
Let's drop some of our inadequate knowledge upon these people.
Well said. All right. Here's our first question. It's from Chris. He says, hey there, Money Tree Podcast. I've been listening to your podcast for about 2 months now, trying to listen from the beginning, but still catch all the new episodes. A little about me. I'm 25, had a 401k for my previous job that I rolled over into an IRA. Now has about $4,000. In addition, I deposit another $100 a month, $4,000 in a savings account, another $4,000 in my checking account. I've recently come into a small fortune, lucky you, an inheritance of about $100,000. I have no intention of frivolously spending this, but rather would like to set this money up to make more money. Of the hundreds of questions an inexperienced investor would have, I'll only burden you with one or two. How can I achieve this goal without putting it into a retirement account? I want to be able to withdraw funds for emergencies or big purchases, like a new car within a year or two. I'm looking into Betterment, Lending Club, and possibly starting an e-commerce shop that my brother might be able to teach me to do. Is my IRA diversified enough in one mutual fund? Is that diversified enough? Thanks for your consideration, your show, and all your awesome guests. Look forward to hearing your response. Let's start with Doug. What would you say to Chris? How can he invest his inheritance?
First of all, yeah, I'm really impressed, Chris, with one of the things you mentioned at the beginning is that you're 25 years old. No, I mean, the thing I'm really impressed with is that you rolled over your 401k into an IRA, showing that you really did want to take a little charge of what was going on. So I'm impressed with that, which I think is very important. I think a lot of people, when they go from job to job, they kind of leave their retirement plan wherever it was, and they never think about what to do with it, and it doesn't become part of their long-term financial plan, and it just kind of, you know, stays somewhere where it's not really thought about. But what I don't quite understand, and I think the question you asked was, how can I achieve this goal without putting it into a retirement account? I don't think you can actually put that $100,000 into a retirement account. This is already taxable money, and that's where it's going to stay. So when you invest it, one of the things to think about is how to invest it in a tax-efficient manner. But given the goals that you mentioned, it's not obvious that we'll be able to do that too much. But let me pass the buck at this point now.
All right, Joe, is he diversified enough? And what do you say about his inheritance?
Well, and I don't know because I don't know what mutual fund it is. I think for $4,000, something like an S&P 500 fund probably is diversified enough. And as that grows, he'll want to maybe expand to two or three different funds that are in different areas. But, you know, I like this idea of starting with the end in mind that's from the Stephen Covey book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, Successful People, Effective People. It's funny, I don't have it right in front of me, but it's one
I
of those two.
I think it's effective, yeah. Highly effective people.
Yeah, highly effective people. And you start with the end in mind. So the frustrating thing, Chris, is that everybody wants to know everything about all the different investments, and clearly you want to do the right thing with this money, which, you know, gives people a sense of deer in the headlights, like, okay, I got all these choices. Well, the choices are a lot less if you start with what you want. So, and you actually talk about that. So for the car fund, I would set up a separate bucket that's a car fund. And with that short time frame, very few different investment types are going to meet that goal. So it becomes a lot easier to invest if you put that money aside in a bucket by itself and put that money where it goes. And then for the e-commerce shop, when do you want to start that? How do you want that money to be invested into the company? I would explore those first instead of the wide range of investments, because it's going to be a much easier task to handle it that way than to go figure out every single investment on earth.
All right. And Miranda, what advice do you have for an inexperienced investor?
Well, I think that Joe kind of handled it really well there. And I like that he's planning ahead and he wants the money to make money, especially this 100K. And I'm more than 10 years older than you, and I'd really love somebody to give me 100K. But yeah, I think starting out pretty simple and pretty small and kind of diversifying a little bit, doing some index funds, and it just making sure you have a plan for it. And I recommend sitting down with somebody, especially with a large sum of money like this. When you end up with a large windfall, the best thing you can do is sit down with a financial professional to help you like map it all out.
I agree with that. I think that's great advice. I think, you know, $100,000 is significant, and Doug was right. There's no way to put this into a retirement account. It's not a retirement plan. It's your own plan. And I would just suggest that you not buy a new car in terms of like brand new, because you're just going to lose value on that and it's going to depreciate quickly. So try to buy one maybe a few years old. But try mainly to keep the money in the market and maybe pick five or six different asset classes, small, mid, large cap, international, and maybe a couple other categories, asset classes, and just be well diversified and invest for the long term. And you'll see this money grow into a significant amount if you keep it in the market for the long term. I think you have an early start, and at 25, you actually have the potential to make millions, I think, over your lifetime. So hang in there.
Yeah, Linda, the claimer to that is he's going to actually use all that money for investing. If you start pulling it out and putting it into like an e-commerce shop and a car, before you know it, you only have like $40,000 in that. That's a big cut into the millions. So I think you got to see that if possible. I think, Chris, if you can just put this aside and kind of pretend you didn't get it, if your real goal is to become a millionaire, like Linda is predicting for you, then then let it all go to work for you and just forget you have it for the next 20 or 30 years.
You know, that's an interesting point, if I can jump in there too, Linda, that Doug makes, is that a good friend of all of ours, Philip Taylor, the guy that created FinCon, he's a CPA, he's been around the block with creating new companies. He's always talked about the most successful way he thinks to create a company, and one of the safest ways, especially something like an e-commerce shop, where there's so many people that have failed, is to not invest a lot of money in it and instead try to make it grow organically as much as possible. Because as you know, as we all know, because we all have online properties, you're going to make a ton of mistakes. And I think that a lot of times investing a lot of money initially before you really know what you're doing, even with help from somebody else who's as qualified as it seems like his brother is, I think it's way, way safer to go in on a shoestring, you know, and learn how to do it without a lot of money before you invest a bunch of cash.
Well, as usual, our group has many words of wisdom. I think those are all awesome. Good job. All right, let's move on to our next question from Sarah. Hi, first, thank you for putting together this podcast. I've really enjoyed and learned a lot from it in the last few months. Do you have an episode that speaks to what tax loss harvesting is and how it works? I just opened a Betterment account where I see tax loss harvesting being mentioned, and I've also heard this phrase used several times on the podcast without really knowing what it meant. I've read up on the basics of it, but now I'm still curious as to how it really works. Thanks again. I'm a big fan of your program and have recommended it to several friends. Thanks, Sarah. We really appreciate that. Who wants to take this one? Anybody up for...
I've been through a whole thing of tax loss harvesting, so I don't mind
diving in a little bit.
Yeah, the problems or the blessings that you get in investing is sometimes you buy something and you sell it for a profit, which means you got to pay tax on it. But the mistake that a lot of people make is they say, well, I'm going to sell. You know, look, I made a profit on this and I sell it. And then they made a profit on something else and they sell it. And they figure the things that have gone down in value, well, they'll hold on to them because they don't want to admit that they made a mistake. And one day they'll turn around and go up. So what ends up happening is, let's say you did this last year, you'd have to pay a lot of tax on all those profits that you realized. When you realize a profit, it means you bought something and sold it for a profit. But the trick of tax loss harvesting is you look through, you harvest your portfolio. That's where the word comes from. You look for positions you have that have actually lost money and you sell them, thus realizing the loss. And then you can tell the government, hey, I lost, let's say, $1,000 on this investment. And if I made $4,000 on the other investment, my net profit is only $3,000. So that's the $4,000 profit minus the $1,000 loss. And so you only have to pay tax on the $3,000 gain. Another reason that people do tax loss harvesting is, let's say you don't have any gains and you just sell positions at a loss and you say, well, I've lost $10,000. You can carry forward that loss till next year and the following year, every year till you die, actually. And if at any point you have a gain, you can tell the IRS, hey, listen, I've got a gain on the stock this year, but 3 years ago I lost money and I want to use that loss against the gain, and so that I don't have to pay tax on the full gain. I can subtract however much I lost and only pay tax on the net gain, which is the amount, total profit minus the amount of losses. So it's a great idea for a lot of people a lot of times. It doesn't make any difference in an IRA or a retirement account because those are not taxed on a current basis. And if you are an international investor, as people who I talk to usually are, it may not apply. So for that, be sure to check with your investment advisors and accountants. How was that, Linda?
That was excellent, Doug. Thank you very much. I can tell you do this quite often. Very, very good. Anyone else have anything to add to that?
No, I thought even the East German judge gave Doug an 8 on that one.
Very nice. Very nice.
Excellent. All right, let's move on. We have Javier. He says, I'm a new listener and already a fan. What are your thoughts on sites like WeFunder? Miranda, are you familiar with WeFunder?
I am not specifically familiar with WeFunder, so that was the sound of me frantically checking this
out. Okay, I actually wasn't either.
I am.
Okay, it says it invests in startups and
crowdfunding. Yeah, I am.
I'm familiar with the kind of site that it is. It's one of the new investment crowdfunding websites where you can use with the new law that allows people to invest in startups and medium-sized businesses that are looking for growth, where you can do crowdfunding for actual investing now instead of just getting like perks like you would get with Kickstarter. So yeah, so they're okay to use, and I've been using I've actually been trying Kickfurther. They gave me some money to play around with, and I've been trying it recently, and I think it can be a fun way to invest a little bit of your play money. I wouldn't put anything that you want to use someday in the future in this, but it can be kind of a fun way to invest a little play money to get a little equity and get some payback and get a reasonable return by investing in startups and feeling warm and fuzzy about, you know, your ability to be an angel investor / venture capitalist / whatever.
All right. Hey, Miranda, just to be clear, can you define what play money is? Because I don't want people to think it's too much fun.
Okay, so it's money you don't actually need for anything like saving for retirement or emergencies or whatever. So I usually have just like a little bit of money set aside that I can use to kind of experiment with. And that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about money that you're not going to miss if you invest in this crowdfunding site, if you invest in this craft brewery that somebody has a dream to open and it just tanks and you lose your money, that's money that you can afford to lose. You don't want to, personally, I don't think you want to take any money that you can't afford to lose and put it into one of these types of sites.
Mm-hmm. Joe, did you have something to add?
Well, I do, because when I was a financial advisor, clients would come to me all the time with ideas like a lot of the ones that I see on the site where, you know, when I scroll down the front page here, I see all kinds of awesome looking ideas. And there's two issues going on. Number one, Miranda explained how this works really well. And because these crowdfunding rules are fairly new and there still is a lot of sorting out going on with them, you're still finding, and this is what the experts in this area tell me, you're still finding that the sweet deals, the really, really great ideas, aren't making their way to these sites. The big time angel investors get the great deals that are some of the sure home runs. And then ones that are more iffy, you know, if they can't get funding from big investors, they'll go to a site like this. So you have to realize that a lot of these ideas have already been pitched to bigger people than you and I, and they've already decided that they're not worth investing in, which, you know, can be troubling. But then the second thing is, it's never about the idea. And this is what I'd always have to explain to clients. It's never about the idea. A lot of people have phenomenal ideas. It's about the execution. So you want to pay very, very close attention to two things. Number one is the people that are involved and what is their background and have they done it before? Because I think a lot of time the right people can make the, you know, a deal happen much easier than somebody that has no experience. But then the second thing is, how rosy are their projections in their business plan? So as you get a hold of the business plan and you're looking through the business plan, I've seen so many business plans, Linda, and I'm sure you have too, that it just seems like everything's going to be unicorns and rainbows. And whenever I read that, I think, oh, there's big problems. I'd rather see a business plan that looks at all of the negatives that could occur and has, you know, deflections off all of those negatives first, so that I know that these people have actually thought about all the things that could go wrong.
That's right. And businesses have been known to be something that has a very high failure rate. So, right. You know, it is only for speculative money. I think Miranda's right on there for, she calls it play money or speculative money. That would just be, you know, a little bit that you could sort of play with and have fun, but not be a major part of your investment.
I thought by play money, Doug, she meant monopoly money, but I guess we were wrong there.
Doug, anything you want to add?
I just want to add, as Miranda was pointing out, there are kind of new rules that let people who don't have as much money get involved in these deals, because they said, oh, it's more fair that now they can get involved in these deals. It used to only be for the rich people. But the reason it was really only for the rich people is because generally, in most cases, not even sometimes, they lost money and they lost all their money on a deal. And what are called qualified investors were people who could handle that better than other people. And, you know, no one wants to do an investment in a high-tech company for $200. You want to put some, you know, you want to put some money in it. And if you don't have the money to lose, then I think you really, really got to be careful of this.
It's funny on Doug's point there, this type of investment strategy, people want to get in there with the rich people and they say, well, if the rich people can have it, why can't I have it? You know, Linda, what's a really cool investment that was made for people to compete with rich people?
Mutual funds
were made because rich people knew that if they put their money in several different stocks instead of just one, that they wouldn't lose their ass. And so they created mutual funds so that the average person can compete directly with rich. You want to compete with rich people? Go buy a mutual fund.
Yeah.
I don't know why we're competing at all. Just figure out what you want from life and what you need to do to make it happen and forget about competing against other people.
Miranda, you're so zen.
I don't know. That's the way I feel about it. Like, I don't care if my stock returns beat you. I don't care if you like my car better than your car or whatever. Just figure out what you want in life and figure out how you can get it.
No, all I do is pay attention to everything Miranda does and I try to do it better.
That's not very hard to do.
All right, moving right along. Our next question comes from Invest Impassionately. And they say, hi, panel. I love your podcast since I get to hear multiple viewpoints on the topics discussed. Keep up the great work and thank you for doing this. I have a question which I'm hoping you can help me with during your next listener questions. Well, here we are. You asked, it's our command. I live in the U.S., but immigrated here from another country. I have money invested in the U.S. and in another country. We plan to settle down, and currently I am debating whether to get the money from the other country to move to the U.S. or not. But in the other country, my bank deposits fetch 7%, which is more than I can get here in the U.S. They are also in long-term index funds with Vanguard, but in the other country, it's mostly in CDs. The other country is India. What are your inputs on how I should make a decision on this question? Any suggestions? Doug, let's start with you since you're our international expert.
All right. Well, in from the international, I just want to comment that the other country, I'm presuming that they're not giving you 7% on US dollar investments, but they're giving you 7% on rupee investments. If you look back over the past few years, the rupee versus the dollar, I think, has dropped about 25% over the past 5 years. So if you're living in the United States and you have your savings in rupee, and if the rupees are actually dropping in value, that's not helping you so much. I think people generally have to look at their money in two ways when they are cross-border investors. One thing is you have to look at your money in terms of your reference currency, which is when you think, how much am I worth? You know, personally, I think, how much am I worth in dollars? Even though I've been living in Israel for decades, I still, my reference currency is dollars, but my living currency is the shekel. And because that's what expenses are for me here. So I think, Mr. or Miss Impassionately, you need to consider what your reference currency and what your living currency is. If you are living in the United States now and you're planning to stay here, but you're keeping money in rupees, so you actually have multiple risks. And one of the major risks that you're adding to your portfolio is the fact that you have currency risk. And we see that you've lost money on the rupee over the past few years. So you've got to decide if that's the kind of risk you want. Just because someone's paying you 7%, if the value of the currency is dropping, in fact, you're probably losing money.
Good point. If you're making 7 and losing 20 or 25% over several years, that doesn't, the math doesn't work out on that one. Anybody else? Miranda? Joe?
I'm just wondering, Doug, though, is also having money diversified among two different currencies a good thing, because you can play both sides of that equation? I mean, if somebody has experience with rupees and with, yeah, I don't do currencies because of the fact that I haven't lived other places outside the United States. But if I have somebody who has experience in both of those different economies, wouldn't it make sense to keep a little money there, because at least I know what that risk might be?
Yeah, I'm not sure people really understand risk. Just look at all the people who buy right before a market crashes in America, and they buy American markets. I don't think that living there is a criteria for making a decision. And in fact, Joe, you could also put your money into rupees and get 7%, but you're not going to do it, not because I don't think you've ever been there, because heck, you've been everywhere, as we recently saw. But you probably just don't feel that that's a great investment, because 7% does sound good. I'd love to make that kind of money, but I'm afraid of the currency risk. So I'm not sure that having experience in the country, unless you are a currency trader per se, makes a difference. I think that exposing yourself to currency risk, just call it what it is. It's a new kind of risk that most people have no familiarity with.
Gotcha.
All right. Miranda?
I got nothing new.
Okay. We'll go on to Chris. Hey guys, love your show. So much advice these days is pushing investors toward index funds. Just wondering what, if any, dangers there are when so much of the market all has the same specific idea. And if there are red flags, what are some counter strategies? Sorry in advance, Miranda. Well, then let's start with Miranda. What do you think about index funds?
I understand.
Are there any dangers of index funds when everybody's got the same idea?
Well, yeah, the main danger with index funds, as with any investment, is there's always a chance you're going to lose money, and that's a problem. But one of the things with index funds and with everybody investing in them, the thing with index funds is it's not really the same thing as having a trade where you're trying to sell a stock, an individual stock, and there's somebody on the other side of the trade that you're trying to like get an advantage of. And really, the point of index investing is investing in the market as a whole, or investing in a large swath of the market, depending on what kind of index fund you use. But the idea behind index investing is investing in the market as a whole. So you're really just saying, okay, I am just going to buy shares of everything in the market and just go with the market. You're not trying to trade an individual stock. You're not trying to do anything like that. And so the main thing you're going to run into is your returns will never beat the market. So if that matters to you, index funds are not for you. Because with an index fund, especially an all market fund, your returns are never going to beat the market, because you're going with the market. Plus you have the minus the small fee that you pay. And so you're not going to beat the market. I mean, there are some index funds where if you pick an index fund that's like maybe like a Russell 2000, like, or some sort of small cap, you might be able to beat the market as a whole, but I still think you're probably not. So the bottom line is with the index funds, it's you're doing the market, you're riding the wave, and your main risk is going to be that you might lose money if you sell while the market's down and lock in your losses. I don't know. Does anybody have a better insight than that?
I think that's the risk specifically of index funds. I think there's a broader risk that we've seen people bring to the table that I think we can set aside here, which is that, you know, there's this kind of groupthink argument that people have that if everybody invests in the index, which more and more people are doing, then, you know, the opportunities are going to be found outside of the index. And while even John Bogle has talked about this risk in the past. I think like he thinks that this is, you know, we're so far away from that, that even though more and more people are indexing, that we're not going to see everybody on that train anytime soon. So that's a risk I hear a lot that I think we can kind of put to bed.
All right, so we won't worry about that. I would just add on to that, that a lot of times people invest in indices and they think they're really broadly diversified, but it turns out they're not. Because, for example, the S&P 500, which is a capitalization-weighted index, even though it has the word 500 in it, meaning there are in fact 500 companies, the majority of the swing in the portfolio is related to about 10 stocks, about the 10 biggest companies. So you don't give yourself a false sense of security by saying you're super diversified if you are in a capitalization weighted index.
I agree with that. I agree with what all of you have said. And I think that, you know, the one risk that I see is that people pick the S&P, particularly since Warren Buffett, I think, suggested that his kids put their money that they inherit from him in the S&P 500, which in their situation, they're, you know, just protecting wealth that they have, even if he's not leaving all of his wealth to them or even the majority of his wealth to them. They still are in the position of protecting wealth. Most people are in the position of wanting to grow their wealth, and I think they need to make sure that they're over all the asset classes. Specifically today, small cap, it seems to be the best performing asset class, as it always is at the tail end of a long bull market, and this is the second longest in history. So I think that it makes sense to have small, mid, large, international, be diversified among the different asset classes and make sure that you're not just all in one index fund, in particular the S&P, for the reasons that Doug just said, I think make a lot of sense. And Miranda forgives you, don't you, Miranda?
I forgive you myself.
Thanks, Miranda. She and I agree on so much.
Okay, one more question from Dan. I love your podcast. It's extremely entertaining to hear four different views on investing every week. A big fear, though, is that a novice will follow Linda's advice to pick individual stocks or Doug's advice to change your stock bond allocation when you feel stocks are too expensive or cheap. Although maybe Linda and Doug can successfully manage people's money that way, I have a feeling that most of your audience are do-it-yourselfers and will try to follow their advice. But since they are not Linda or Doug, they will not be successful. Miranda's index style is a great way for DIYers to invest, but as Doug said, her shtick is to downplay the benefits of her investing philosophy when she says she chooses passive investing because she's lazy and boring. We know Miranda's not. Yes, we do know that she's not. Could you please have a guest talk about the pros cons of passive or index investing and why they think it is better or worse than Linda or Doug's methods? Maybe on a Q&A show, Miranda could talk more in depth about why she chooses not to invest in individual stocks or do market timing. I would love to hear a debate of this on your show. Thanks, Dan. Gosh, you know, I feel like we talk about this all the time, so I feel like we've already answered this question. I also feel a little bit misunderstood, but I will let Doug talk first and then I'll chime in.
Well, Dan, all the studies seem to show that that almost all of the returns of a portfolio are directly correlated to your asset allocation, meaning what percent you have in bonds and what percent you have in stocks or other asset classes. It's not about security selection. Sorry, Linda. Not that you can't be clever about how you select securities, as Linda and I use in the same sentence, Warren Buffett, both are. But given the fact that we know, that, you know, study after study has shown that that people who develop a smart asset allocation model based on who they are and what their goals are and who maintain it, they're the ones who do okay. And although, of course, I encourage people to work with financial advisors, DIYers can do this themselves as well. It's just something they can work on. There are all sorts of online, you know, calculators and tools you can use to figure out what makes sense for you and then go ahead and apply it. Needless to say, get advice from an advisor, but if you're not going to do that, asset allocation is certainly going to be the best tool you'll have rather than trying to become a genius stock picker.
Yeah, I mean, I feel a little bit misunderstood because I actually don't feel that I come on and tell people to invest in individual stocks. I do say that that has been my success method from the past, but even with my own group, I'm not using individual stocks, I'm using ETFs. So I don't understand that, although I defend how to pick stocks, or we talk about earnings being important for stocks, but that's because the stock market is made up of stocks. It's not because I'm trying to pick the best stocks out there. So I'm investing in ETFs. I talk all the time and several times already on this show about being broadly diversified among multiple asset classes of small, mid, large, international, etc. I'm not a big fan of bonds right now. Everybody knows that. But I'm not telling people that they should be out there picking stocks. I'm not doing that for my own individual group, and I don't manage other people's money. So just to be clear, I feel a little bit misunderstood. Hopefully that cleared it up. And I do think that DIYers, that's why I do a podcast, is for DIYers. That's why we're doing this podcast, is for people who do their own investing and to learn their own, or who augment that with a financial advisor like Doug, who manages money. So Doug is actually the only one here who does handle other people's money. So just to be clear on that, hope that answered the question. And Miranda, do you want to add something about your philosophy?
Yeah. So the nice thing about indexing is that it's really one of the things that we, when you look at the research, you look at the studies, one of the main problems people have is that they trade at the wrong time. And extra trading just adds extra expenses. You run the risk of selling low after you've bought high. And one of the nice things about indexing is you can take advantage of a large swath of the market. It helps you be diversified, which, as we know, is a very important part of investing. So it helps you diversify your holdings, and it encourages you to think long term and hold on to that and reduce the amount of trading that you do, because that's where most do-it-yourselfers get caught up. And that's where a lot of them run into trouble, is the trading, and trading at the wrong time. And as humans, we're wired to just panic and trade at the wrong time. And the other thing that's great about indexing is when you compare the performance, the long-term performance of indexing versus actively managed mutual funds, index funds come out ahead. And you're more likely to do better over a long period of time with an index fund versus an actively managed mutual fund. So that's something to keep in mind as well. And so I like it from the standpoint of, it's easy to diversify. I don't have to worry about tinkering with things too much. As Doug says, asset allocation is important. So over time, you know, eventually I'll have to tinker with it a little bit and rebalance. But indexing is just a way to kind of make sure that I stay on top of things, to make sure that I'm not doing anything really stupid, and to kind of keep those returns that help me reach my own goals. Since I'm not concerned about beating the market, I'm not concerned about any sort of competition, I'm more concerned about how can I reach my own goals. And indexing helps me do that without too much trouble.
Joe, what do you think?
Well, I love the gentleman's point, but I agree with you, Linda. I'm hoping that if somebody is a do-it-yourselfer, that what they get from this podcast, at least what I hope they get, is that you have to do your homework. You can't just go buy things. And that's where all of us have seen do-it-yourselfers make mistakes in the past, is they just get impulsive and they go and they just try something crazy. And guess what happens? It doesn't work. And when it doesn't work, instead of adjusting and tweaking, they just abandon it and go on to the next thing that, guess what? That one's not going to work either. So I think it's do your homework, start with the plan, and then execute the plan and tweak it when it doesn't work until it does work. Because I think the cool thing I like about what we've seen on this podcast is there are multiple paths to victory, and there isn't one, you know, set way that's right for everybody, but there certainly is a way that's best for everyone listening to this, but it's going to be different from person to person.
All right. Well, that concludes our show for today, but let's hear what's going on with everyone's podcast. Miranda, what's going on with Planting Money Seeds?
Yeah, so I'm actually writing again at Planting Money Seeds for Real Reels this time. You can read about my bad money diary, all the terrible things I've done with my money the last six months of 2016. I've also written about for Women's Money Week, which was January 1st through the 7th. I actually wrote a few posts about what women can do to improve their financial situations and address the problem that there is still a financial health gap related to gender. It's not about a wage gap. If you read my stuff, you'll see that it's not about the wage gap. I'm talking about the financial health gap that we're still seeing. And so go ahead and check out Planting Money Seeds and read about that.
Excellent. Doug, what's going on at Goldstein on Gelt?
At Goldstein & Gelt, we are coming out with a brand new, totally updated, super cool website with lots of neat stuff at goldsteinongelt.com. Not there yet, but just sign up there, and then we'll tell you when it comes out. And also, Rich is a King, we just did a cool podcast, which people seem to like because the market has gone so high, called When is the Right Time to Buy Stocks? And that's at richisaking.com.
Okay. And Joe, how about Stacking Benjamins?
We are cranking up for the new year, Linda, with reopening our course to help people save 50% of their income, not 15, but 50. So that's at stackingbenjamins.com/save50.
Great. And over at Be Wealthy and Smart, we have the leading ETFs of 2016. So you can see what has been leading going into the new year. And as usual, thank you for listening. And if we covered your question today, we'd love to hear a review from you and get some feedback on how you thought we handled your question. That would be interesting. Miranda, you want to take us home from here, please?
Yeah, make sure you visit us at moneytreepodcast.com, where you can see all of our past episodes and learn a little bit more about the free resources that are available to you as you invest. Don't forget to leave us a review, ask us a question, and remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do, so invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.